This is the State of Things, broadcasting from the American Tobacco Historic District. I'm Frank Stachow. Reading has always offered an escape into worlds unknown, sometimes into the world of ourselves. Traveling to faraway lands and having vicarious experiences has never been as important as it is now. As we stay home and shelter in place, reading provides us an opportunity to exercise our imagination without leaving our recliner or our couch. So we thought we'd invite some writers to talk with us today about their work and find out what they're reading, and maybe they will offer us some suggestions about books we might like, too. Martha Waters is a children's librarian in Chapel Hill and the author of To Have and To Hoax. It's a historical romance set in 19th century England. It is her first novel. Martha, welcome to the State of Things.
Thank you so much for having me.
How are you doing?
I mean, hanging out in my house a lot, but doing pretty well otherwise.
Hanging out, miss it. You must really miss a library. That must be, I mean, that's a place I miss. I love to take the grandkids there, and I just feel like, painful, that is one of the most painful losses in some ways.
Yeah, we've been hearing from a lot of patrons telling us they miss us, and we miss them a lot, too. I miss seeing all the kids every day.
I miss talking to Lee Smith, who is with us now. It's been a long time. Lee Smith published, this is your debut novel, Martha. Lee Smith published her first novel in 1968, and since then has become a New York Times bestselling author. Her new semi-autobiographical novella is Blue Marlin. Lee Smith, welcome back.
Thank you so much. I'm delighted to be here.
How are you doing?
Well, I'm doing okay, and I'm glad to hear you, Martha. This is great.
Do you know each other?
Nice to talk to you.
Do you know each other?
No. No, but I have spent so much time in that library. When I had little children myself, I used to escape to that library so I'd have a place to write.
Really?
Oh,
that's interesting.
Yeah.
With the kids?
I'd get a babysitter and go right in the library.
The muse. So Martha, talk about this. You're a first-time author, and your book was released on April 7th. Not quite what you envisioned, I would guess, for the publication of To Have and Hoax, right?
Yeah, it was definitely not the publication day I imagined. I was supposed to be having a release party at Flyleaf here in Chapel Hill, and I had family and friends who were coming in from out of state for it, but, I mean, by mid-March, it became pretty obvious that none of that was going to happen. So I did a virtual launch party that all my friends came to instead. I just did an Instagram Live, and I mean, it's been disappointing, but it's also been very kind of heartening the way like all my family and friends and just the book community at large has been really supportive of debut authors. So it's been different, but good in a different way.
I can't imagine that. There's that whole gestation period where you're sort of thinking about the novel and then you actually begin putting it together, and it takes however long it took to finish the book and wrap it up and get it published. And now the moment arrives. And they tell you everybody's got to stay indoors. I can't imagine what that feeling was like.
You know, what I've been trying to remind myself that I actually found really helpful was that it's like this time 2 years ago, I didn't even have a literary agent yet. And if I had told myself that my book would be sold and it would be released into the world, but the catch is that it has to happen during a global pandemic, I would still take it. I'd be like, yeah, sure, whatever it takes.
Sure thing, sure thing.
That helps.
I can get this bug going if you need. Lee Smith, now you've been through the publication and promotional process many times before, but it's never been quite like this. I mean, what is this? How are you taking all this in?
Well, it's, you know, I miss going to bookstores. I miss that because it's, you know, I love to see the readers. I mean, you're not a writer if you ain't got a reader, and that's the time you get to meet them, and I love that. But this has been very different. One thing that's been really interesting to me is that I've had I seem to be having a kind of a virtual book tour on Zoom, and Zoom is something I never even heard of until suddenly I was supposed to hook up with it. Southern Booksellers Association, for instance, had a hookup reading, debut reading for this book and me with about 60 bookstores throughout the South, and people could get on Zoom too. And so I gave a reading and then answered questions. And I mean, I am so low tech, I couldn't believe it, but it was really fun.
So this is your novella now. It just released,
yeah,
Blue,
yeah,
Marlin.
Yeah. Yeah. And so I was, got to hook up with a lot of people from Zoom. And then there's a group of women writers from New York who all, you know, for all people whose books are, this is the situation, they started something called A Mighty Blaze, which is on Instagram and, and you know, the web and everything, where writers interview other writers in an attempt to get some of this stuff out a little bit. So it's been an interesting thing with all these new kinds of things.
Do you think it's
happening?
How about the sale of books? Up, down? Does it have an effect? Can you tell?
I'm sure it's going to be down. Sure it's going to be down. But on the other hand, I really believe, both from all the people that have been showing up on these Zoom things and book groups that have been calling me up and asking me if I would talk by phone or Zoom to just their book group, I think more people are reading. I'm reading more. I mean, I think more people are reading during this time than ever before. Book clubs are meeting like crazy, virtual book clubs. And I think we all, you know, we all have a hunger now for books and for reading, which can transport us out of our very circumscribed lives these days, you know, into all kinds of other worlds. And I think there's more reading going on right now than ever. And I have a hunch there's probably more writing going on.
Well, some are and some aren't. I want to ask you about that because we've talked to other writers, too. I was just talking to Randall Keenan, or we as a show were talking to Randall Keenan, who said he's having a hard time reading now. His concentration. I wonder, Martha, for you, if it's easier or harder to write in these times and whether your concentration's affected.
I feel like I've gone through kind of phases. So like a month and a half ago when all this was first starting, I was having a really hard time reading or writing anything or really doing anything other than refreshing the New York Times app on my phone over and over again. Not very productive or good for your mental health.
No, that will not help your concentration at all, but go ahead.
No. But I feel like, I'm kind of getting used to this new normal that we're all living through right now. And so I've been able to start reading again, and I've been able to start writing again, which is convenient because I'm currently working on revisions on my second book on a kind of a tight deadline. So being able to concentrate again has been helpful. But I definitely still have days where I wake up and I make the mistake of like reading a new story first thing in the morning, and it makes me so anxious that my productivity like half the day is totally shot. So,
what were you about to say, Lee?
I was going to say, if I'm trying to write at all, I can't even check my email or hear the news or anything in the morning before I do it, because then it's all shot.
Well, what about in these? I mean, with this in the background, even if you don't refresh the Times app, you know, there it is, kind of humming in your ear. And I know that Lee, you're already working on a new book, right? During all this, how has it affected? Has this affected your creative process at all?
I think it's the great escape for me. And the minute I start either reading or writing something, I'm there. I'm in that other world. And so for me, even more so than movies or any other thing, it's a great the great escape for me. And then I can go back maybe more refreshed and a little bit rested.
Is this to
my own real life?
Well, that's interesting. I mean, certainly you have more time to contemplate your own life, even if you're with fewer appearances, even if you are on social media.
Yeah. That's another thing I wanted to say. It seems to me that, I'm not only a great proponent of reading, but also writing and the therapeutic nature of us all writing, journaling, writing about our lives. And it seems to me that in this unprecedented time, it gives all of us, everybody out there, more time to write. I mean, you know, write down those early childhood memories for your grandchildren, or that year you spent in the Peace Corps, and get children writing and journaling. I like to see the kind of journal that looks like a scrapbook where they can draw on the page and write on the page and paste leaves on the page or just whatever, because, you know, this has never happened before, and this is important, you know, to everybody. It's so important, and this is happening to us and happening to you, and these kids, they will want a memory like that.
Well, but it's interesting that you say that, because then there are two dimensions, it seems to me, that this puts you into, because of the kind of the stay-at-home nature of it, but also the global consciousness, right, that we're all sort of facing. On the one hand, if you were to write, your COVID-19 would be all over the page to some extent because of the way it's affecting your rituals, your routines, your relationships.
Yeah.
On the other hand, it's this moment where you can put that aside and go deep into the things that you hadn't thought about forever.
Exactly.
And it's nothing to do with this. But I wonder if
that's right. Either way, I think it's very therapeutic. I think it's just because it gets, you know, writing gets your fears and your thoughts and your dreams and just all kinds of things out of your head and onto the paper. You know, putting words in any order gives an order to chaos inside. I mean, I just think it's very helpful for all of us, and it's fun for kids. You can get them reading and writing, particularly writing and drawing and telling stories, you know, during this time, I think is great.
Well, Martha,
also, if you're a parent working from home right now with like trying to keep your kids occupied, if you can get them like journaling or something, I think that's like a really good thing for kids to do, and also a really good activity if you as an adult are trying to actually get work done with children underfoot.
Yeah.
So multiple benefits.
Do you guide them, Martha? Let me ask you, as a librarian, children's librarian, is there a way to guide? I mean, let's say I don't do a lot of writing and journaling, and I've just heard this, and I thought, wow, what a great idea, but I don't know how to guide my kids in this. I mean, give them paper and pencil and say, go to it, I'm going to vacuum, or what do you do?
I think you can give them,
You give them a little prompt of one time or another, you know, and just say, just give them, you know, just give them a prompt, give them papers and pencils and sequins and, you know, stuff, and say, okay, if you could make up a country that you would really like to live in, or make up a new animal, or write about the funniest thing you've seen lately, or the scariest thing you've seen lately, or make a map of your neighborhood and draw all the neighbors. You know,
that
kind of, just give them an idea, and they get going.
They do.
They just need a teeny idea.
They do or they don't. Martha, what do you do when they say, I can't think of anything? Or and then if they do get started, do you come back and hover? Do you patrol? What do you do after the first paragraph?
I would say being hands off as much as possible tends to work better. And also, it's like always very surprising to me how much kids will really run with an idea. It's like if you give them a pretty simple prompt, most kids like they will take off with it. And even if you have a kid who's pretty young and maybe can't write that much yet, I mean, just let them draw something. Tell them to look outside their window and draw five things that they see. Like kids can occupy a kid for like 30 minutes.
Oh yeah, the drawing is great, and it's so interesting because so much is revealed, I think, in the drawing and the art to the parent, you know, or the teacher, or that it's just, you know, and it's it's good for the kids.
Well, I was just thinking that myself because, you know, as a parent, you are so focused on keeping your kids safe and keeping things running in this kind of crazy environment. You might not notice all of the cues. So this might be a good way to check in and say, oh, my goodness, where did that come from? Let's talk.
Yeah.
You know? Yeah. I think it's hard because, obviously, adults are very anxious about things right now. And I think it's really hard to keep that out of your interactions with your kids, like, as much as you try to. And so, especially with older kids, like upper elementary school kids, like, I think they're probably worried, even if they don't want to tell you that they're worried.
Right.
So this can kind of be a good way to, like,
well, they're smart. They see that you're worried and they don't want to worry you. I mean, you know, that's the same thing. They get it, and they get that they don't need to be a bigger problem than you've already got. You know, I don't care how old they are. They figured it out, right?
Yep.
Hey, let's talk about your writing, too. I don't want to miss that. Martha, debut novel, To Have and To Hoax. Tell us a little bit about this novel. By the way, it's a romance, but I detect a wrinkle in your eye, a little bit of a wink as you write this romance.
Yeah, I've been calling it a romantic comedy. It's set in Regency England. It is about an estranged married couple named Violet and James who got married very young, even by Regency standards, and got in a big fight and basically haven't really been on speaking terms ever since. And so Violet decides to fake a case of consumption to get her husband's attention, as one does. And James very quickly sees through this plan because it's a very, very bad plan. But instead of calling her out on it and having a mature conversation, he plays along with it. And so it becomes a sort of escalating battle of one-upsmanship. They're basically playing chicken with each other to see which one of them is going to call the other one on their bluff first. So, and then, like, spoiler alert, they fall back in love in the process because it's a romance novel.
Well, I love that you wrote this long, you know, started this long ago, but they're faking some kind of medical emergencies, which is kind of fun these days, I suppose.
Yes, I could not have predicted promoting a book in which someone is faking a deadly respiratory disease in the middle of a pandemic of an actual deadly respiratory disease.
The consumption, though, I kind of like that.
Yeah.
Well, listen, I know you prepared an excerpt for us. I think in this, James is visiting his wife, Violet Gray, by the way, in her sick bed. She is now feigning this case of consumption, also trying to catalog the entire contents of their library without him knowing it, because she's quite bored with pretending to be ill. Is that a pretty good setup for her? Do we need to know more?
That's about the perfect setup.
All right.
James sat down beside Violet on the bed, then immediately leaped to his feet once more. Violet watched him, perplexed, before she realized the cause of his sudden motion, the feeling of several sturdy, leather-bound books beneath the bedspread. He reached underneath the counterpane and retrieved one of the offending volumes. Violet said. He quirked an eyebrow at her. "You see," she said, improvising hastily, "I felt my mind growing disordered, and so I felt that reading something familiar and comforting might make me less confused." It was, as even Violet would admit, not her best work. She was supposed to have consumption, for heaven's sake. She wasn't a mad old maiden aunt who wandered about the house at all hours of the night in confusion. "I see," James said, then peered at the spine. "And you found Agricultural Innovations of Shropshire, 1700 to 1800, to be just the sort of comfort read you were looking for?" "Drat." Violet said again, thinking quickly, "I thought it might include some sheep." "Sheep?" James said blankly. "Yes, sheep," she said with greater enthusiasm. If she was going to do the thing, she might as well get into the spirit of it. "You know, about hip height, very woolly."
Martha Waters, reading from her debut novel, To Have and to Hoax. I'm also here with author Lee Smith. Just tell me a bit about historical romance. Now, what was it that appealed to you? Clearly you have an eye for it. I wonder if you really love them or if you wanted to do this bit of a spoof all your life.
I came late to reading romance. I didn't really get into it until I was in library school because they made us take a class called Popular Materials where we had to read a book from like a different genre each week, and we did romance 1 week. And I think I kind of came into it thinking this is not going to be very good because that's kind of the reputation romance has. But the book I read, which was by a really classic romance author named Julia Quinn, was very, very funny and charming and delightful. And I really fell in love with the genre. So I started reading a lot of Regency romances because I'm a lifelong Anglophile. So it was really right up my alley. And I'd always wanted to write and thought I wanted to write for kids and teens. But once I started reading romance, I just loved all of the banter and the jokes and sort of the witty comments and stuff so much. I love writing dialogue, and it just felt really natural. So I decided to give it a go, and To Have and to Hoax as the result. But I definitely also was kind of, I think people who read a lot of romance will notice that I am sort of like poking fun at some of the genre tropes, but hopefully not in a mean-spirited way.
It's in a very warm, loving way. It's you know, I love this, and by the way, I've noticed this about this particular form. That's the way I read it. And Lee Smith, what accounts do you think? I don't have a heck of a lot of time in this segment, but we'll come back. What do you think accounts for the popularity of these romances?
I think because people know that they're going to get lifted out of their own actual world, and they're going to have an experience of, you know, that kind of reading experience that's going to really refresh them and so on, and they know what to expect, and they know that it's going to be okay, it's not going to upset them, and they're going to love these details and the banter, and, you know, it's just like taking a safe trip with some wonderful companions.
I'm talking to Lee Smith and Martha Waters. Both have recently published new novels, and we'll talk about that. And we'll ask Lee Smith if she'll read From a Blue Marlin for us, which is her new semi-autobiographical novella. Talk to both of them more and more on the state of things when our program continues after this. This is The State of Things. I'm Frank Stacio. Well, if you've ever found it difficult to keep up with your reading habits lately, partially because you're distracted, maybe you're exhausted because you're having to do so much at home you don't have time to read, or maybe you've exhausted your reading list. Who knows? But you need some new ideas about what to dive into next. Well, our guest can help you today. Martha Waters, children's librarian in Chapel Hill, author of To Have and to Hoax, a historical romance novel set in 19th century England. Lee Smith, New York Times best-selling author. Her new semi-autobiographical novella is Blue Marlin. Lee, let's talk about this novella, Blue Marlin, based on an actual childhood experience you had with your parents. Tell us about that.
Yeah, actually, a wonderful trip that I took with my parents in 1958 when I was 12 years old. And the deal was that my parents had been separated for better than a year, or about a year. They had both been in separate hospitals, Daddy in a mental hospital in Connecticut, Mama, same kind of deal, but in Virginia. And then it came time, everybody was better, and everybody's going to get together with me, the only child. So unfortunately, it seemed like there was, however, some kind of problem with the marriage. And so Daddy's doctor, who was a brilliant man, prescribed not only lithium, but a geographical cure for the whole family, a geographical cure for the marriage. And that was that we should all take a trip and take a trip for, you know, about a month, 6 weeks, and just kind of get to know each other again under different circumstances, kind of exciting and romantic circumstances, as it turned out, because my father picked Key West as the destination. Wow. He had been in the Navy in Key West, and he'd always loved it. So, okay, we all get in the big fishtail Buick in Southwest Virginia and drive to Key West, which took forever and was not going too well. I mean, they were practically not speaking to each other, and the whole car was full of cigarette smoke, and things were not going too well when we finally arrived in Key West and checked into the Blue Marlin Motel, which is still there, right on Simonton Street. Huh. And anyway, Daddy went in the motel, came out, and paused and said, okay, girls, you're not going to believe this. And we said, what? And he said, we are the only American family here in this motel. The entire rest of this motel is taken up with the cast and crew of a movie that's being shot here in Key West named Operation Petticoat. And we said, who's in it? And he said, well, there's Tony Curtis and Dina Merrill and Cary Grant. And my mother just went, because alone of all people, she had a real subscription to the National Enquirer, and we read all the love stories and movie magazines back to back all the time. So things changed. We checked into our room, and things happened. And before long, Mama was wearing a hibiscus in her hair, kind of a smile on her face. And so that was the beginning of a kind of a wonderful experience.
Well, can you read for us from the novella?
Sure. What I did is the real trip and the real things that happened. We ended up being in the movie and stuff, but you make up, you know, you up the ante a little bit with fiction. So I made up a little narrator who is much more obstreperous and sort of bothersome than myself. And the parents are not really me either. This is the first paragraph of the novel, and then I'll do you one paragraph about Mama. In 1958, when my father had his famous affair with Carol Bird, I knew it before anybody. I don't know how long he'd been having the affair before I found out about it, or, to be exact, before I realized it, before it came over me. One day, I was riding my bike all over town the way I always did, and the next day, I was riding my bike all over town knowing it, and this knowledge gave an extra depth, heightened dimension and color to everything. Before, I'd just been any old 13-year-old girl on a bike. Now, I was a girl whose father was having an affair. A tragic girl, a dramatic girl, a girl with a burning secret. Everything was different. All my conversations, especially my conversations with my mother, became almost electrical, charged with hidden import, pregnant with meaning in the lingo of the love magazines and movie magazines she was constantly reading. Well, okay, we were constantly reading, for my mother loved The Lives of the Stars above all else. And then here's one little paragraph about Mama, the character Mama. Some people said Mama looked like Marilyn Monroe, but I didn't think so. Mama was bigger, blonder, paler, softer, with a kind of inflatable celluloid prettiness. She looked like a great big baby doll. people also said that I took after Mama. But this wasn't true either, at least not yet, and I didn't want it to become true, at least not entirely, as I feared that taking after her too much might eventually damn me into lying down a lot of the time, which looked pretty boring. On the other hand, I was simply dying to get my period, grow breasts, turn into a sex pot, and do as much damage as Mama, who had broken every heart in Charleston and had a charm bracelet made out of fraternity pins to prove it.
Lee Smith from her new, they had to take the mic out because you would not have heard you. I would have just been circling all the way through. Reading from her new book, Blue Marlin. By the way, you can find Lee on Facebook Live in a conversation with author Camilo de Mayo on May 7th, courtesy of the women's writers group A Mighty Blaze, which you referenced earlier. And we're also here with author Martha Waters, whose new book, her debut novel, in fact, is to have in hoax. So Blue Marlin, yeah, now I know, you know, to some extent, all novels are somewhat autobiographical, in your case, Lee, some more than others. Is this the first time you've written about somewhat about yourself at so young?
Well, no, actually not. I've had a child narrator. In fact, my first novel, a million years ago, had about a 12-year-old child narrator. And as a child, I was one of those children who's always doing that drawing and writing. You know, talking about.
Well, that first one was because you won a contest, right?
I did. I won a contest in college, and so at Hollins College, a wonderful school for writing in Virginia, and it was like it was later published. I mean, a great stroke of luck, I think, for a young girl. But anyway, this was so much fun and so satisfying to write because it really brought back my own parents, who were just lovely, lovely, adorable people, and that particular time and place. I have to say, every night at 7 o'clock back in the Blue Marlin Motel, Tony Curtis would call Janet Lee on the telephone, and my mother would sit down right in front of the public phone and pretend to be reading newspapers. And at the end of it, he would say, "God bless you, my darling." And Mama and I would go, "Oh," like this, and rattle our newspaper. It's completely true. We did it every night. Finally, Tony Curtis asked us, he said, "Would you ladies like to be in the movie?" And we said, "Oh, yes." And he gave me some nabs, which I still
You still have?
Yeah. So it brought this all back, and it also allowed me to play with that concept. And, you kind of up the ante when you write fiction. These parents were much more. So there was no affair. I mean, these parents were much more, much more adventuresome and interesting in certain ways that are good for fiction. But the events of the trip are true.
Well, let me get just a couple more real-life details. Number one, what part did you have in the movie?
Oh, I just have a part in the crowd.
I see.
There was in Operation Petticoat. It's one of the worst movies ever made. There's a pink submarine, and when it goes out to sea, we were in the crowd waving goodbye, goodbye. And when it comes in from the ocean, we were in the crowd waving hello, hello.
The last detail I'd like to know in real life is how did it work out for your parents?
Great. We got in the car and drove back to Grundy, Virginia, with a quick stop at Weekiwachee Springs, because by then I was determined to become a mermaid when I grew up. And Daddy ran his dime store for 30 more years, and they were happily married.
Well, I'm glad you chose writing over Mermaidia, because there's not a lot of money in mermaiding.
That's right. You can't age too well as a mermaid.
Martha. let me ask you now some recommendations, because we talked about recommendations for parents and getting kids to write, but I think people are out there wondering what to read. If you've gone through your list, Martha, what are you reading these days, and what would you recommend we all read?
I'm perhaps unsurprisingly really gravitating towards comfort reads right now, which I think is true of a lot of people at the moment. So I've been doing some rereading. I've just started rereading my favorite historical romance series, which is called The Bridgertons. It's by Julia Quinn. It's actually coming to Netflix later on this year. So
probably will shortly be very popular. And it's just a very warm, funny, historical romance about this big family with a bunch of siblings who all fall in love. And then I've also been, I was really obsessed with James Herriot's children's books when I was a kid. And so I've been reading all of his adult books just about being a vet in Yorkshire in like the 1930s and 40s. And
Finding it
incredibly comforting. Like, I just read like a chapter or so at a time, like before bed, and they're very, very comforting to me right now.
So the book that that your hero finds in your novel, under the covers of his wife, about the agricultural practices of Shropshire, is not far from the truth.
Exactly.
My goodness. I've got someone on the line who wanted to be a mermaid, and now someone who wants to be a shepherd. And nobody can get out. So that's part of the problem. Well, that's wonderful. Lee, what about you? What are you reading? What should we read now?
You know what I'm reading? I'm reading a new book by Loretta Lynn that she wrote about Patsy Cline. And it's named Me and Patsy Kicking Up Dust. And I'm having the best time because I've always been totally fascinated by Patsy Cline, who grew up in the mountains of Virginia herself, although some sort of farther east than me. But anyway, that's what I'm reading. And I just find that I'm reading a lot of, as always, fiction. I'm reading the wonderful book Olive Again by Elizabeth Strout. It's a return to her main character named Olive Kitteridge in the book of that book of that title. I just love Olive Kitteridge, and I love that book. And then I just read a book that's on the bestseller list. Actually, it's just absolutely wonderful. It's named The Giver of Stars by JoJo Moyes, and it's about the librarians. Hey, this is a thing. It's about the librarians in Kentucky, eastern Kentucky, rural Kentucky, way back, years ago, who delivered the books on horseback. Wow. And this is really true, and it's actually something I always wanted to write a book about it, and damn if JoJo Moyes hasn't already done a great job. So I recommend that book to everyone. Again, a big story, an important story, because it also has to do with the mining and so on that's going on there, and it's really good. And then I'm reading a new novel by a young Asian, brilliant, brilliant writer named Jean Kwok, Searching for Sylvie Lee, which is good.
Wow.
So I just read that.
Well, I know everybody recommends Escape at this time, but I have to say, I'm just going to throw this in. Nobody asked, because I would have to ask me, and I'm not going to. But if I were to ask me what I'm going to read, The Last Man, Mary Shelley. The Last Man. Now, it's an apocalyptic. It's set in like nearly 2100. It's like 2073, right? She writes this apocalyptic novel in 1826 when there's no such genre, which is why the book was panned when it came out. Nobody liked it.
Huh.
It's revived in 1960 when somebody, gets it off the remainder's bin and says, look at this. Mary Shelley wrote another book. And it's called The Last Man, and it really is about a guy, about these people who survive a global pandemic.
Really?
Down to the last man, and it is a further, also by then she had suffered enormously. She lost everybody who was close, her mm-hmm. children and her husband. So it's a meditation on grief, but it's also a deeply smart and I think very clear look at politics, her sense that the romantic project had failed. Really smart book. So The Last Man. But you have to have an appetite for, reading about what we're going through.
Mm-hmm.
All right. I'm going to leave it there. But Martha, what about parents who want books for their kids at various ages? What suggestions do you have?
There's a couple of new ones that just came out in the past month or two that I've been really impressed by. One of them is Prairie Lotus by Linda Sue Park, which is basically a sort of reimagined Little House on the Prairie with a protagonist who's biracial. Her mother is Chinese and her dad is white. So they move to this small town in the Dakota Territory and kind of confront a lot of racism. So it's kind of a more up-to-date version of Little House on the Prairie, but also like all the things that people love about Little House, like people sewing their own clothes and setting up a homestead on the prairie is there as well. And I really, really loved that one. And there's another one, a debut called A Friend Divided by Ernesto Cisneros that just came out this month that I read. And it's about a kid who's Mexican-American, and he's a citizen because he was born in the States, but his parents are illegal immigrants and his mom gets deported, which sounds very heavy, but I felt like it was a really age-appropriate kind of introduction to a topic that kids have probably seen in the news a lot in the past couple of years. And I found it ultimately very hopeful, and I just found it like a really, really impressive debut. So both of those are new releases that I think are really, really excellent.
Well, I want to thank you both so very much for talking with us. Martha Waters, children's librarian in Chapel Hill, author of To Have and To Hoax, a historical romance set in 19th century England. Martha, thanks so much for being here.
Thank you for having me.
Lee Smith, New York Times bestselling author. Her new semi-autobiographical novella is Blue Marlin. Lee, thank you so much.
Well, I'm delighted to be here. Thank you.
We've got links to all their work at our website, stateofthings.org, and we want to hear from you. Are you a small business owner who's been affected by COVID-19? Has coronavirus changed your summer plans? We have a survey asking you about your experiences during this time. You can find it on our Facebook page, or you can call us at 919-980-5419, 919-980-5419. We've got that number at our website, stateofthings.org. If you want to get in touch with us, we want to hear from you. State of Things produced by Anita Rao, Amanda Magnus, Grant Hall of Mormon, Kaya Findlay, and Stacia Brown. Josie Taras is our intern. Jenny Lawson, our technical director. Al Wadarski helped engineer the show today as well. North Carolina Public Radio is a broadcast service of the University of North Carolina at Chapel Hill. I'm Frank Stacia.